Are you from San Diego? Or are you from here?
No, actually, I'm from Chicago originally. I grew up outside of Chicago in a little town called Naperville. I actually came out to San Diego to go to graduate school at San Diego State University. I was at San Diego State for graduate studies in kinesiology and biomechanics, something totally unrelated to photography.
Do you find that kinesiology and biomechanics help you in your photography?
Only in the way that I started my career in medical sales because I had a background in kinesiology and biomechanics. And then through a very circuitous route, I ended up working with an organization, a health-related organization, that needed some photographs to illustrate their programs. And then it was that initial connection that I got in the medical arena that ultimately brought me to where I am today in photography and photojournalism, specifically humanitarian photojournalism for non-government humanitarian organizations. So had I not gone through that whole process, I may have not ended up where I am right now. But it was largely unrelated to photography in the beginning.
How did you make the jump between the medical world and photography?
I was working in pharmaceuticals and orthopedic sales and sales management. And over that period of time, I would go to these large trade shows. And I'd be standing around our trade show booth talking to physicians about total knee replacement or total hip replacement or sports medicine or whatever. I don't know, one day I was kind of bored at the booth and I walked around and I saw a booth that was advertising for volunteer physicians to go overseas to do humanitarian work. And on this booth that they were displaying their wares, trying to get doctors interested in going overseas, they had some photographs of places like India or South America or Central America. And these photographs were not very good. So I approached them and I said, you know, I work for this orthopedic company and I spend my vacations traveling around to the developing world photographing indigenous cultures. And I said, some of these photographs might do very well to sort of illustrate the places that you're asking physicians to go. And I said, I'd be more than happy to provide free images to this organization because I thought they were doing a very neat thing, sending doctors overseas to do cleft palate surgeries, orthopedic surgeries, or whatever. So in the very beginning, I started providing images from my personal vacations, my trips to this organization. And they found that they got a lot better response at their booth because there would be this nice picture of somebody in a foreign land and people would go over and take a look at it and that would spark a conversation, which ultimately helped them do what they were doing. So, yeah, I don't know, it was probably 5 or 6 years of sort of just helping this organization out. And little by little, I started thinking to myself, I really enjoy photography and I really enjoy the positive things that come from my photography. I was getting a lot of satisfaction knowing that my pictures were being used to help people somewhere else in the world. So I said, well, why don't I try to figure out how to create a job that allows me to do just that, travel, photography, and primarily in helping people on the other side of the world? Because having been involved in medicine in the United States and having traveled in the developing world, I very quickly, as anyone would, notice that there was a big difference between healthcare as we know it and healthcare in other parts of the world. And that's frankly the reason why a lot of physicians volunteer their time. They want to give back to a community that doesn't have access to good healthcare. Well, I wanted to give back and try to figure out how I could provide information, photographs, photographic information, imagery from these places to try to encourage physicians, nurses, or even people that were thinking about donating to an organization to donate money because it was for a good cause. And, you know, one thing led to another. And, you know, before I knew it, I decided to get out of the career that I was in and move over into photography, specifically humanitarian photography. Well, my first international assignment to do photography for a humanitarian organization was to document the efforts of health volunteers overseas at all of their sites around the world. So I spent several months going to Africa and Asia and South and Central America to document these doctors that were in doing surgeries. And having spent 10, 15 years prior to that standing around in surgeries with doctors, it was really easy for me to be in an operating room, moving around in an operating room, because there's a protocol and there's an etiquette to being in those places. So as a photographer, I had this huge advantage that I knew my way around an operating room and I could be in the right place, not be in the way, get the pictures. I knew what was going to happen next. So I had this big advantage having understood operating rooms and healthcare and spending decades in a hospital as a salesperson or as a manager. Now I'm just in there with a camera. So the transition was easy in that regard.
What about learning f-stops and apertures and shutter speeds and things like that, lighting and direction of lighting, color of lighting?
Well, I've never taken a photography class. As a child, I started photographing at a young age, and you know, it was always a hobby for me, and then I got into it more and more. And so I was at that point, before I had taken on this job, I was a fairly decent photographer, because the organization wouldn't have sent me if I was in a position where I was learning photography. So lighting for me was lighting and composition and that. I mean, I was a fairly adept photographer by then. And I had also worked for a small newspaper, several small newspapers. And that's a really great place to learn how to create a photograph, especially if you're trying to create a photograph that tells a story. Because, as you know, a newspaper is going to run one image, maybe two, if you're lucky, three. So when you go out on a newspaper assignment, you have to be able to capture the story in an image. As a freelance photographer working for a newspaper, you're going to get sort of stories that aren't all that visually exciting. You may be sent to the grand opening of the new preschool over in, you know, X, Y, or Z community. Now you've got to go to this preschool where they're having a ribbon cutting ceremony and make it look interesting. And so those assignments that I took on that weren't very interesting taught me how to make something that wasn't interesting interesting. And so when I found myself in a very interesting environment, that it was easy to make images because there was so much there.
So you leaned on that newspaper experience.
Oh, very much so. Newspaper experience is one of the best arenas for learning how to tell stories with pictures, because that's what it's all about. Where every single day we pick up a newspaper, we look at the pictures, and we don't realize the amount of information that comes out of that picture. If you look at newspaper photographers and you look at how they shoot and what they shoot, you learn a lot about how to compose an image. When you stop and think about it, the newspaper photographers, the stuff that makes the front page, those are all great images.
So it's not only composing a good shot, but it's telling the whole story in one shot, if at all possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you are at the tsunami, for example, as I was recently, you have to get an image that includes enough elements to tell the whole story. You're not going to be able to go to the beach and take a shot at the beach and then go to a destroyed house and take a shot of the destroyed house and then find a person that you want to take a picture of. You've got to get that all in one shot. So you're constantly looking for all of the components that tell that story, and you need to fit them in a rectangle. And sometimes that's difficult. And that's why newspaper photographers excel at what they do. They're able to get all the components into a single shot.
Like many photographers, you'll take oodles of shots just to get one.
Yes, yeah, that is correct. I take, probably during the initial days following the tsunami, I shot 400 to 600 pictures a day.
Okay, we're going to divert a little bit and maybe come back to the nuts and bolts of photography. But I wanted to get this question out to you. What is the most controversial issue that you've had to deal with?
I would say that covering HIV/AIDS can be controversial because you're dealing with content that's sort of sensitive and you're dealing with cultural sensitivities. And so,
do you photograph people with AIDS?
Sure. I guess there's two ways to kind of get imagery that depicts controversial things like HIV/AIDS. One of them would be to act as a paparazzi and go and get the shot. And that is going to net one type of an image. It's going to be that voyeuristic grab sort of thing where you're getting a picture of somebody who's either unaware of your presence or bothered by the fact that you are there. And so that's the way that you don't want to get it. The way that you want to tell the story of somebody with HIV/AIDS is to create some level of rapport with that person, and that generally means not leading with your camera. If I'm in an area where I'm photographing people with HIV/AIDS, the first thing we want to do is establish contact with those people, talk with them, make them feel comfortable that I'm here for a reason, and that reason may be to educate others, to help other people, to tell their story, whatever that is. And that's without the camera, right? You start in and you essentially get permission from someone and you get their cooperation so that you can get into their space, into their life, and begin to tell their story. And frankly, it doesn't really matter. In most situations, people who have been affected by HIV/AIDS, who have been affected by a tsunami or a hurricane, they want people to understand what they're going through. It's something that people want to be able to express to other people, and they often cannot do that. And as a photographer, many times as a photojournalist, people will really open up their lives because they want that story to be told for the benefit of someone else or to just be able to talk to someone. I remember walking around in the tsunami and there was people who had just lost everything, and they would come up to you and they would just start to talk to you because they felt the need to explain their situation to someone, to express it verbally and to get that information out. And then when they find out that you're a photographer, they say, hey, come to my house. This is where I used to live. This is what happened when the tsunami came. Or I was diagnosed with HIV/AIDS 6 months ago, and I was very weak, and now I'm on an antiretroviral program, and look how what I'm doing now. I can walk, I can go to the market. So, you know, they want to involve you, and they want you to document them oftentimes in order to get good imagery and intimate pictures of people in those situations. You have to build rapport, you have to build trust, and sometimes you build that with a translator who's able to translate what you're saying. If you're not with a translator, you definitely don't lead with the camera. You show interest in someone's situation. You try to smile as much as you can.
What about governments and of the countries that you go to? Are they an impediment to the process of you doing your photojournalistic humanitarian job as a photographer?
Governments and politics do play into the photojournalist's ability to do their job. And there are places where I go that governments, for example, don't want photographers to be. For example, previous year I traveled to Sudan, and the situation in Darfur is not good, and the Sudanese government would rather not have people, specifically photographers and journalists, over there documenting things that are going on, because a lot of what's going on is not something that they want out. And so I remember arriving in Khartoum, Sudan, and had I not had connections on the ground and what we call a fixer, someone to help me through the airport and through customs and out, had I not had a fixer, there would have been no way that they would have let me in the country with my camera gear, because I was obviously a professional. I was obviously there to take pictures, and they wouldn't have got me in. They wouldn't have let me in had I not established something prior to getting there and having a fixer to get in. Fixers in a place like Sudan are people who know the ropes, shall we say, who are able to grease the right palms, who are able to troubleshoot for someone from overseas. And fixers are generally people that work with the media, journalists, photojournalists, writers, camera people, TV people. And a fixer will be somebody that is able to get you past some of the red tape. Now, that's not necessarily inexpensive. Like, for example, when I arrived in Khartoum, my fixer met me. He somehow got beyond the security people. He was right there when I got off the plane. He whisked me over to an office where he then asked me for my passport and took it in a room and had a discussion with some official. And then he came back out and he said, you know, we need another $100. And so I handed him $100 and he went back in the room. And next thing I know, my passport and my visa were stamped, and we were off to the next area, which was immigration, and I had all my cameras, and he said something in Arabic to the gentleman that was there at the immigration, and next thing I know, they didn't look in my bags. I just was whisked off places like Haiti and places like Afghanistan and places like Sudan and Uganda.
Is there someone that travels around with you after that?
A fixer typically will be with you during most of your trip.
Okay.
So it's someone that can translate for you. It's someone that can help out with the red tape. In the case of Sudan, this person was associated with an organization that I was shooting for. So I spent most of my time with this man who was my translator, my driver, my fixer, and became a really good friend. And if I was to go back to Sudan, I'd call him up.
About how often in a location do you end up spending?
typically spend about 2 weeks on a particular story in a particular location, but it really varies widely based on the story. If it's the tsunami, I mean, I may spend, you know, a month because there's just so much there to be told. But if it's a small, compact sort of story, I recall I did a story on HIV/AIDS in the brothels in Cambodia. And that was like a 1 week shoot where, you know, I kind of got in with a group of an organization that was working with a group of prostitutes, and we went in and told their story, and that took about a week. The idea of anti-American sentiment is probably something that you, when you get to a country, you experience less than you would have expected, having been in this country, watching the news and listening to the news and thinking about it. For example, I was recently in Afghanistan, and the Afghan people are really, really excited to find an American, and they're very welcoming. Generally, they're very happy. Now, obviously, I didn't talk to any of the folks that were remnants of the Taliban. They probably wouldn't have been happy to see me, but most Afghans on the street are very happy to find out that there's an American, and they'd shake your hand, and they'd say thank you, and they'd say, wow, you know, it's just great that you're here and interested in my country and you're telling the story about what's happening here.
Obviously, many of the pictures are of people that are in deep poverty. How does that impact you, and what goes on in your heart when you are on assignment like that?
It's probably about 180 degrees from what you initially think. If you're in a city and you're driving past a slum or some severely impoverished area, and you kind of whiz by that and you go to your hotel and you have a nice dinner, you'll have a feeling of, geez, you know, that's, you know, a feeling of maybe guilt that you're in one situation and somebody's in another. But if you really take the time to stop and go in and meet the people and talk to them and photograph them and maybe spend a significant amount of time with people who are really impoverished, you have a completely different experience. I'll give an example like Haiti. The first time I went to Haiti, it was just shocking. It was, this is a horrible place. I don't want to spend any more time here. I want to get out of here. But when you get a little bit deeper and you go in and you meet people and you talk to them, there's this real sense that these folks have a very difficult life, yet they are persevering. It's almost like it's inspirational to see human beings who are in real dire situations able to continue on where most people would just give up. And Haiti's the perfect example of that. It's this terrible place that's riddled with poverty and disease and crime and everything, but it's inspiring to go there and see that the people are living their lives on a day-to-day basis, getting up, going to work, doing their jobs, trying to improve themselves. You walk away certainly figuring to yourself, there's got to be a way that we can help these people out of this situation. And you feel for them, but you also, it's inspirational. It's you say to yourself, you come back and you say, well, my problems here at home, because my email doesn't work, are so insignificant. If I can't get the brand of coffee that I want because it's no longer available, is that a big deal? No, not at all. It gives you a perspective of your own life that's completely different.
So they're dealing with disappointment on a level that none of us here in the United States could ever dream of.
There's a photograph on the wall up here of a woman by the name of Ya'at, and she's sitting in a temple at Angkor Wat in Cambodia. And she has no hands and she has no feet. And every day she gets up and she goes to the temple at Angkor Wat and she sits down and she has a little incense that she sells. And when somebody comes along and they want to say a prayer or make an offering to Buddha, she sells a little incense stick. And she gets it with her, what's left. She doesn't have hands. She has sort of where her wrists would be. And she picks it up and she hands it to this person. And then she takes the money and she puts it on a little pot. And I remember staying and photographing her several nights at Angkor Wat. And at the end of the day, she would gather up all of her stuff and she would walk on these little stubs that used to be her feet off into the jungle. And to this day, I look at that photograph and I say to myself, I have no problems. I have no problems that can ever come close to anything that she's dealing with on a regular basis.
If there was any message or a lesson learned that you could impart to others, what would you say to them?
My answer would be, if I could give everybody in the world a plane ticket to some faraway destination, that would be the best advice I could give anybody. It's just take a person from our environment and put them in a completely foreign environment, and that foreign being another country, another culture, and then all of these preconceptions and misconceptions start to go away. Because really, when you take the time to see people and visit people and talk to people and engage people in other cultures, what you find out is we're all very similar. We all want to have a place to live and a meal, and we want to see our children raised and have a better life than we did. Everybody's really after the same thing. And oftentimes we think this culture is stereotypically this, or this culture is stereotypically something else. And really, we're all very similar. And that's what I found out from travel. I wish I could take everybody with me and have them experience what I experience and come away with maybe a different idea than what they get from mass media or from watching TV or from reading newspapers. And since I can't take everybody with me, I try to bring home images, and then I try to talk to people about those and show those and make those available to other people. And you mentioned that a lot of my photographs would be people that are in dire situations. And I bring home images like that because I want to get people's attention. But then I'll always back those images up with something a little more positive, something that shows a sense of hope. Because most of my clients who are in the business of providing relief or aid to people who have been impacted by disease or tsunamis or natural disasters, they want to have an image that shows that, boy, there's a bad situation over there. But they also want an image that says to their viewers that there's hope, there's a way to get out of that. There's people that are eating the food that we're bringing, or getting tents that we're bringing, or blankets or whatever. So you need both those images that tend to draw a lot of attention and sometimes shock people. But you also, and probably more importantly, you need to come away with an image that provides people with a sense of hope and certainly maintaining the dignity of the people who are in that photograph. And even those photos that I have where people are looking very forlorn and very in a dire situation, those are photographs that have been made with their permission. And they were comfortable with me taking a photograph of them in that situation. And then maybe beyond that, we're able to get them in a situation where their expression has changed and there's a little bit of hope in their eyes. And we show those images as well. You know, there's this big sort of idea that one digital camera is better than a digital camera over here, or film is better than digital, or digital is better than film, or a Nikon's better than Canon, or the Epson photo printer is better than the HP photo printer, or whatever. It's really, in photojournalism, it's not about the equipment. It's about the image. And if one shoots film in a Leica or digits in a Canon Mark II, it really doesn't matter, because what matters in photojournalism is the story, and what tells the story is the picture. So whichever device you use to record that image is far less important than creation of that image and what that image has to say. So my advice to photographers is get comfortable with whatever gear you have and go out and make pictures that tell that story, and don't worry too much about it. The folks that hand out Pulitzers don't care whether you shot it on a Canon or a Nikon. I think that technology has changed the world of photojournalism and the world of photography, and it's changed it in a positive way, specifically for photojournalists. There are some photojournalists that still shoot film, but since photojournalism is often about immediacy, digital has provided a great advantage in terms of getting images from someplace quickly out to someone else. So digital has created a whole host of advantages for photographers, specifically photojournalists. And I think one of the most powerful things about digital photography is the immediacy of it. If you were a writer, a reporter, and you're going somewhere to tell the story of something that's happening, you would go out during the day and you'd make interviews, and then you'd go in the evening and you would write down you'd start to write your story. And 3 days, 4 days later, you're able to look back at your story and read it and say, well, you know, I really need more information about this or information about that. I'm a little bit shy on that. Well, in the film days, you didn't often have the ability to look at what you shot today or the day before. You had to wait until you got back to some place where you could develop your film. And so now digital photography is much like writing, maybe. You can now go back and say, well, I shot this Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And now that I look back on it, I need more information. I need more imagery about this aspect of the story because you're able to go back and look at it. It's like being able to write the novel and go back and see what you wrote on page one. And in film days, you were writing the novel, but sometimes you didn't get a chance to go back and see what you wrote or what you shot, for example, back on day one. And that's the power of digital.
So the photojournalist chimps.
Photojournalists will chimp a little bit during the day, for sure. And the photojournalist will look at his computer every night and then evaluate where he is in terms of telling the story and whether or not there are weak points that need to be reshot or to get better pictures about a certain topic.
So what would you say to the purists out there that think that chimping is cheating?
This whole idea of chimping. I think chimping is something that's very powerful. Let's face it. If you're in a very challenging lighting situation, in the film days, I don't care how good you were, if unless you were in a studio and you had it dialed in and you knew it was going to work, if you were out in the field, every situation is different. Photographers in the film days, I've talked to photographers back in those days who shot stories or weddings or whatever, and there was always this anxiety, did I get the shot? And now with digital, you can look at the back of your camera and you can say, well, I've got something that looks like what I think I need. You can't look at it in high resolution because the back of the camera doesn't allow you to do that. But you can pretty much tell whether you got the lighting right and whether you have the composition right. Maybe you can't see whether it's completely sharp or not, but it's a very powerful tool. And anybody who doesn't use the tools that are provided to them is disadvantaging themselves. And if that tool is available, I'll use it. I certainly evaluate my images on a nightly basis, and I chimp during the day. If I'm in a challenging lighting situation, I chimp to find out whether or not I'm where I should be in terms of color balance, in terms of exposure. In fact, I was shooting in Sri Lanka, and I carry two cameras. I carry one with a wide lens and one with a long lens. And I was photographing a group of women who were part of a program revitalizing the economy following the tsunami. And so I shot some wide shots and I picked up my 70-200 and I was shooting a tight portrait of this woman. And I had been in the same room, in the same lighting situation. I was shooting portraits of her as her expression was changing and as she was gesturing. And I may have shot 20 pictures of her in the process of doing this. And then for whatever reason, there was a lull in the action and I chimped. I looked at my camera and I looked down and I had this line going across the frame, this big black line. And I thought to myself, oh, my camera strap must have been caught on my lens hood and was obscuring the front of my camera. So I turned the camera around and I looked and no, the strap wasn't caught on the lens hood. So I took another picture and I had this black line across it again. I looked at the back of the camera. Well, I quickly realized that I had a broken shutter blade. And had I not chimped, I would have continued to have shot and I would have had frames that were no good. But in fact, I hadn't really chimped in the last couple of dozen pictures because I knew the lighting situation I was in wasn't changing. So I wasn't looking at the back of the camera. The good news is that I had some images that were okay and some that weren't. And then I immediately had to switch to a camera that worked. So now I was swapping lenses back and forth. Getting into photojournalism at this time, it's a very fluid time in photography and specifically in photojournalism. Newspapers are tending to hire more stringers and less staff people. Same thing with magazines, wire services. So the traditional photojournalist who works at the local newspaper or for the magazine, those jobs are probably becoming fewer and fewer and fewer. But at the same time, the need for still images is going up, up, up. People need images for their websites, for their magazines, and for their newspapers. And before we had the web, there was print, and that was pretty much it. Well, now there's this whole need for more and more images. So as one market is getting harder and harder to get into, another market opens up lots of opportunities for photographers. So there's probably just a shift between, there's a reduction on one side and an increase on another side. So, but photojournalism is not something to get into if what you want to do is make a lot of money with photography, because photojournalists are typically not very well paid, and most people do it because they love doing it, not necessarily because it's economically the easiest way to make money. If a photographer has to make money in the business of photography, there are a lot of other ways to do it and earn more money. Weddings is one example. Shooting weddings is much more lucrative than shooting for the newspaper or being a freelance photojournalist, because typically people are willing to pay a fairly good price for someone to come in and photograph their wedding. Whereas a photographer's daily rate working for a newspaper is frighteningly low.
Why do you do it then?
It's something that I feel compelled to do. I do it because I absolutely love it. I was riding in a vehicle across the desert in Sudan. I was with two individuals who work for humanitarian organizations. We're driving across the desert in Sudan, and it was a long day. We were driving like 6 hours across the barren desert, nothing going on, just the occasional burro or, you know, camel or whatever. And so the conversation is just going on in the vehicle, and the two gentlemen sitting in the back, one's a physician, the other works for an NGO, and the conversation came up, if you won the lottery, what would you do? And I was sitting in the front of the vehicle with the driver, not really being part of this conversation, but I was overhearing it, and I was interested to hear what both of these gentlemen were going to say. Well, one of them said, well, if I won the lottery, I'd travel around the world and I'd do this. And the other guy said, well, if I won the lottery, I'd quit my job and I would do this or that. And I thought to myself, if I won the lottery, I'd be sitting right here where I am right now doing exactly what I'm doing. I've already won the lottery. I love what I do. It's not a job for me. It's exciting. Sometimes I have to pinch myself when I get up in the morning and say, do I really get to do this? It's just amazing, and I love it. All types of photography, photography is such a joy. I mean, the creation of images, for whatever purpose, it's something that, you know, you work hard at, and you get this tangible thing. You get a piece of paper or a screen, and you can say, look what I did. And then you can evaluate it. You can go back and you create it. And it's like golf. You're always chasing the next level. So at all levels of photography, you're always interested in moving forward. So there's always a challenge. There's always going after that next shot. It's something that, you know, you can do for the rest of your life as a professional or as an amateur, and you'll never get to the point where you say, well, that's it, I'm done. That was the last photograph. I've reached the pinnacle, and that's it. No. You better believe that anybody out there who makes a great photograph, is once that's in the can and on the wall and sold or bought or whatever, they're looking for that next image. What's the next one going to be? And that's the excitement of photography. And digital, I think, has done nothing but create a wonderful renaissance in photography. Photography is now, everybody's got a camera. Camera phones, little mini cameras, digital cameras. Everybody's emailing their pictures across, posting them on websites, talking about them. And so I see the future of photography as continuing to just grow, and it's fun for everyone. It's a way to share things. And now with the availability of digital, I think it's probably going to, you probably tell me, it's probably growing exponentially. Camera clubs are more busy now. People with digital cameras are getting out there and sharing, and websites such as yours, more people are going out there trying to get information because they're interested in photography, and now everybody's sharing photography, and we can all learn from the experiences of others. Grab your camera, go out, and have a great photo adventure.